This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
This podcast is a production of kcrw.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, a long-languishing remake of the 1939 classic film The Women gets a makeover with Dove Beauty Products. It's good for the film, it's good for Dove, and it's great for the agency that put the two together. Plus, what the hell is a first AD anyway? But before we go there, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. With one-quarter moisturizing cream, it's The Business from NPR. It's the Hollywood News Caravan. Mad Men, the AMC cable network's new show about the advertising industry in the 1960s, doesn't debut until July 19th, but it's already looking a little shaky. You see, Jack Daniel's Tennessee Whiskey is sponsoring Mad Men in a product integration deal that has the show promoting JD both on and off the screen. Like, say, when a young ad exec is thoroughly soused at his bachelor party, he gets visibly shellacked on Jack Daniel's. Last week, the consumer watchdog group Commercial Alert filed a complaint with the Trade Association for Distilled Spirits, alleging that Jack Daniel's sponsorship of Mad Men violates its code, which prohibits alcohol marketing in association with, quote, depictions of irresponsible drinking, overt sexual activity, or sexually lewd images, unquote. The scene in Mad Men kind of seems to violate all three. So much for enjoy responsibly. Speaking of responsible enjoyment, HBO chief Chris Albrecht lost his job last month after a violent drunken altercation with his girlfriend outside the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. But Albrecht has bounced back faster than you can say 12 steps. He's said to be guiding a version of the HBO series Sex and the City to the big screen, with the original cast intact. Trade reports say Albrecht's involvement is unofficial so far. Per Variety, quote, when a distrib deal is in place, the company and Albrecht will figure out if he'll be a credited producer, end quote. We predict that once Albrecht's just a teaspoon less radioactive, in, say, a month or two, an announcement will be made that a hedge fund is backing Albrecht's new production company and that Sex and the City, the film, will be written and directed by the show's executive producer, Michael Patrick King. So, I guess it's true. What happens in Vegas really does stay in Vegas. Meanwhile, the New York Times took note of a media alert sent out last week by a Los Angeles dress designer. Quote, Nikki Hilton wearing Kate and Cass to visit Paris in prison, read the headline. Anya Torres, the owner of Kate and Cass, said she has since received requests from about 50 stores seeking to place orders for the infamy-adjacent frock. Torres told the Times, quote, of course it's an unfortunate situation, and I wouldn't want to capitalize on it, end quote. Finally, a computer hacker has posted what he says are key plot details that reveal whether Harry Potter lives or dies in the seventh and final J.K. Rowling book, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. The computer wizard, who goes by the nom de web Gabriel, claims to have hacked the computers of London-based Potter publisher Bloomsbury and posted the plot information on insecure.org, a hacker site. Wrote Gabriel, quote, we make this spoiler to make the reading of the upcoming book useless and boring. Gabriel. If useless and boring were impediments to pop culture success, half of Hollywood would be out of work. Now, the only thing you've done is given Harry some free publicity. And God knows he needs it. Like Hagrid needs a hamburger. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later in the show, Dove is cooing about its deal with Hollywood. But first, Hollywood's Master Sergeant. Nobody took any real notice when the first assistant director of Too Fast, Too Furious was fired from the set back in 2002. After all, first ADs get canned all the time. But the gentleman in question, who is black, claims that he was fired because of racial discrimination, even though the director of the film, John Singleton, is also black. The case came to trial in federal court last month. But we're not here to discuss the merits of that case, but to answer a more basic question. What the hell is a first AD anyway? Earlier this year, the business producer Matt Holzman visited the set of the action thriller Crank to find out.
The Rats had this abandoned factory in downtown L.A. all to themselves last week. But now a pack of production people are scurrying around in their fleece jackets and jeans, talking into walkie-talkie headsets and sporting utility belts that would make Batman blush. They're working on an action film called Crank, about a hitman who goes on a killing spree after discovering that he and his girlfriend have been poisoned. All week long, the heroes, played by Jason Statham and Amy Smart, have been chased through this dark, dusty location by gun-toting, suit-wearing gangsters. But no one seems to be in charge. There are tall captain's chairs with the directors' and producers' names on them, but they're empty. Fear not. The assistant director is here.
Okay, let's get Amy and Jason over here. We'll do a little rehearsal. Let's get rubber guns. We only need rubber guns for this. We don't need the real thing. Let's get it quiet, please. Quiet.
If you didn't know any better, you'd think that was the director talking, but actually, it's first assistant director Bill Clark.
It could look to a novice that I'm in charge. In reality, I'm just the eyes, the ears, the mouth of the individual who's in charge running the ship, the helmer, the director.
You wouldn't know Bill Clark unless you've worked on a film with Bill Clark, and then Bill Clark is the man to know. Where the director might be the captain of a film, the AD, as they're called, is the master sergeant. He's the guy who keeps the whole three-ring circus running smoothly.
Yeah, sometimes there's five rings. You got your cast members, your background actors, your stunts, your vehicles, your props, camera information, special effects, makeup, wardrobe, makeup hair, animals, music, sound, art department, set dressing, greenery, special equipment, security, additional labor, visual effects, mechanical effects, stunt personnel, video playback, transportation, voiceover, precision drivers.
The job of the first AD starts months before shooting does, working with the director and producers to break down the script into a precise roadmap of what will happen, where, with what, and with whom. They'll revise the schedule when locations are set, and again when the actors are cast, and anytime anything changes. Now that they're shooting, Bill has become the Buddha, sitting in the midst of the maelstrom, a walkie-talkie earpiece on the left, and an earpiece with the audio of what's being shot on the right. And both ears are always available to the crew.
Do you have 8 minutes to move everything downstairs right now?
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah, I would say. I mean, what are you worried about rolling on this? I mean, if it has to be MOS, it's MOS. Nobody needs to say anything. You can get overwhelmed because people are coming to you every day, all day, with all, you know, typically their problems, and you have to try to help them find solutions for these problems. And sometimes you can get overwhelmed and you can, you know, somebody can lose their cool.
The AD's main responsibility on set is keeping production moving forward efficiently and on budget, despite a million moving parts.
Yeah, we had talked about being down here at 11:30, remember? You said 10:30, I said 11:30, and it's actually 12:30.
I thought we were including the...
Okay, guys, nobody can be on these stairs. Everybody's got to tuck around. Tuck around. I'm going to break these guys for lunch while we do this shenanigans.
It is 100% controlled chaos. There's a lot of elements going on. A lot of people have a lot of different jobs and a lot of different concerns. And keeping that all streamlined so they all come to the same point, and the point being the things that are happening in front of the camera, is what we have to do.
The stars of the film are the very picture of carefully crafted dishevelment as they get ready to run once more from the bad guys, crawl through a window, out onto the fire escape, and of course pop off a couple of rounds.
Okay, here we go. Quietly.
Take two.
And roll sound, please. Fire in the hole. Two rounds, guys. Fire in the hole.
Two rounds. Keep moving up.
Sound speed.
Marker.
Good. Settle and action. Okay, it's a cut. Did you get any better than that? Shall we go down and do...
The directors, there are two of them on this film, are nowhere to be seen during this shot, and as a matter of fact, I don't think I saw them all morning. But these are action scenes. There's not a lot of dialogue, and Bill Clark has plenty of action experience. He was the first AD on both Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill movies, which doesn't mean that things always go as planned.
There's always going to be a surprise or two, just the nature of the beast, but you want to eliminate as many of those surprises as possible.
When there's a mistake on set, it's Bill's job to gently chide the offenders and keep them on task. At one point, an assistant held up the shot because he'd forgotten to put film in the camera.
Any luck with the camera yet?
Oh, need a tape. That's embarrassing, huh?
What's interesting is that the job of taskmaster turns the first AD into a kind of double agent, working for both sides of an enterprise whose interests sometimes conflict. He's trying to implement a director's creative vision, but also do the producer's bidding and keep the production on time and on budget. This is particularly important on this film, which is directed by two first-timers. If you watch carefully, you'll see the producers sidle up to Bill and ask how things are going.
Yeah, we're good. We're good. We got a lot of work.
But the first AD's allegiance is first and foremost to the director.
If there's something I know is just going to put the director in a foul mood, I'm going to take it away, you know, and get something that's right. Because we want to keep a positive working environment, and I want to solve the problems before the director has to. This way the director can focus on the things that are actually important and on their plate, which is a ton.
For The Business, I'm Matt Holzman.
The dizzying amount of information and entertainment options these days has created a cat-and-mouse game between advertisers and consumers. And the omnipresence of advertising messages in general has turned commercials into background noise. So, advertisers are having to find, or invent, clever ways to break through the clutter. As a result, the relationship between brands and Hollywood now goes far beyond mere ads. There's promotion, McDonald's carrying Shrek toys in their Happy Meals and Shrek characters to sell Big Macs on TV. There's placement, for instance, three of the desperate housewives just happened to drive Nissans. And more recently, companies are getting involved earlier in the production process to integrate their products into storylines. Most notably, Nabisco's deal with TV show Seventh Heaven last year. Here's an Oreo cookie montage.
Don't you dunk? You're a twist and dunk, right?
I like the cookies separate from the milk. I'm a purist.
You know, I used to be a twist and lick. Now I'm a dunker.
Yeah, have some Oreos.
Oreos? My favorite.
I think what they're saying is you can give a person a few Oreos and they'll talk to you.
Are those Oreos?
Lucy dunks in front of the family. When she's with me, she twists and scrapes the filling off with her finger and then dunks just the outside.
Oreos are my favorite.
Now, some companies even have a hand in creating their own Hollywood projects. A new pact is some kind of mad hybrid of all of the above. The deal weds Dove Beauty products to a remake of the 1939 George Cukor classic, The Women.
Will you please let me do what I want with my own life?
You're very confident, aren't you?
Yes, because I know Stephen couldn't love a girl like you. Well, if he couldn't, he's an awfully good actor.
Dove products will be featured in the film, and the brand's involvement in the project will be closely tied to Dove's Campaign for Real Beauty. Dove also invested cash in the film, which means they could make money on the movie over and above the promotion. But this deal is also a coup for the talent agency ICM. Their client, Diane English, has tried for more than a decade to get The Women off the ground. With Dove signed on, the film's a go picture. ICM will now not only reap 10% of Diane English's fees as a writer, producer, and director, but they also get a fee for securing Dove's involvement. Lori Sale put the deal together. She's head of global branded entertainment at International Creative Management.
Lori Sale, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
What are the details of this groundbreaking Dove deal?
They're still working on their plans, but it's everything from having Diane English blog on their site while she's making the movie, all throughout the course of the movie, and really have access to Dove consumers to tell them about the process. Because I think most people really don't realize what goes into a movie. You know, you buy your ticket, get your popcorn and your Coke, and watch it, and you really don't know what goes into making it. Mm-hmm. You know, the majority of this cast and crew, well, in fact, all of the cast will be females. There's no men in the movie. So it should be an interesting shoot, an interesting process, and I think will be interesting to consumers, and Dove will bring them that access.
You came to read the script how?
ICM has an international finance division where what's happening in the world of film is that actually films are being financed privately and shot, and then studios are sought out for distribution and marketing. Mm-hmm. So in putting this package together and looking for investment for this film, a colleague of mine, Hal Sadoff, gave me a copy of the script. I read it absolutely loved it. It felt very contemporary. It felt very real. And I thought, well, this is something that Dove might be interested in.
We should point out that The Women, in addition to being obviously a remake, has been in development for, I think, 10 years now, right?
I think 13.
13.
It's been waiting for me.
Would this movie have gotten made without Dove?
This movie would definitely have gotten made without Dove. This is a great fit for this movie. I mean, it's hard to know. Maybe the next day the phone would have rang with a private investor who wanted to invest in the movie. I just think that this was the last piece that needed to come in place, whether it was Dove's money or someone else's money. It was the last financial piece. So it turned this into a go movie.
So take me inside these discussions with Dove. If the movie hasn't been made yet, all you have is a script.
Words on paper.
What can you guarantee them?
We sent the script first and said, just read it. And that was really all we needed to say. They read it. They loved it.
Who's they in this case?
I went through Dove's agency, a great friend of mine, Patty Ganguza, who works for AIM Productions, who counsels Dove and Unilever, which Dove is a part of the Unilever family, on a lot of their access to entertainment. Mm-hmm. So I said to Patty, just read the script. You'll love it. She called back and said, I completely get it.
And where does this go from there? Like, does it go to the chief marketing officer? Does it go to the CEO of Unilever?
In Dove, it was really a team of people. So Patty circulated it amongst her clients. And then we all got together for a meeting. We literally took the producer of the film and the director of the film to New York to sit down with Unilever. And really, that's when everything came to life, because all of a sudden, words on paper became these two amazing women who are going to produce and direct this movie.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what those discussions are like. Now you're all in the room together, and you're able to say what? I mean, this seems so amorphous and so unevolved.
And that was part of the fun of it, is that you know, everybody had their sort of own vision, but now words on paper became this amazing writer-director, Diane English, who you know, was the creator of Murphy Brown and has made her career really creating characters that are very real. So the folks at Unilever were very taken with her and really heard from her the vision of the movie that she wanted to make. So once everyone was in love, we decided to, you know, date a little and then figure out how we get married.
Well, $3 million is a hell of a first date. I mean, I'll buy you a drink.
That number came from where?
Well, according to— The number has been reported in the Los Angeles Times and elsewhere that the commitment from Unilever is $3 million. So just because for my own purposes here, I'd like to be able to pry loose $3 million from someone at some point. What's the process like? How do you fall in love?
You have to learn about each side. So they have to learn about literally the logistics of making the movie. Who's going to be in it? When will it be shot? If it's shot in a certain month, when does it come out? How long is the shoot? How long is the post? So when Dove is hearing that information, they're able to say, all right, this movie may come out in a certain time period. What is our business like during that time period? Mm-hmm. And then how can they take all the things that they need to do and use images from the movie and a relationship with the filmmaker and with the actresses in the film? So as we're going through what they might do with it, we ask them to literally go away and say, all right, if you're in this movie and it's coming out at a certain time, how can you support it? How can you get around it? What will you do?
If the movie makes money, can Dove actually sort of make money on this deal over and above the promotion?
Dove's primary business is moving beauty products, so that's really what they're involved in it for.
Okay, but they are investors in the film, it's fair to say.
Yes, they are investors emotionally and financially, and really a great partner.
Coming up after a short break, more with ICM branded entertainment guru, Lori Sale. She helped broker a deal between Dove Beauty Products and the remake of the classic film, The Women. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser, actor. We're talking about a new deal between Unilever, the makers of Dove beauty products, and the producers of a remake of the classic 1939 film, The Women. Unilever has made a reportedly $3 million investment in the long-languishing project, and they've planned all sorts of product placement and promotion with the film. Laurie Sale brokered the deal as head of global branded entertainment at International Creative Management, which also happens to represent Diane English, the writer, director, and co-producer of the film.
The LA Times piece that I referenced earlier about this deal was titled A Step Beyond Product Placement. But that would imply kind of a level of commercialism beyond integration or placement. Is that the right or wrong headline for this story?
I think it is a step beyond product placement. I think that it really is much more brand integration and a brand relationship. And I think that now more than ever, what is happening in Hollywood is that brands are having dialogue directly with those folks who create entertainment.
But that's not integration, really, is it? I mean, there's no guarantee that we're even going to see Dove products in the movie, right? Or is there?
There is, but some product would have been there. The way that the script is written, the way that the story is told, the way that the characters are, you know, in their kitchens, in their bathrooms, in the places you would ordinarily see product. And Dove trusts Diane and Victoria Perriman, who's the producer, and Diane English, who's writing and directing. And there really hasn't been a word that's changed from the script that Diane originally created.
Let's talk about that for a second. How do clients at ICM react to this kind of stuff? I mean, when you come to them, or do you come to them and say, hey, we've got money, have you got a project you want to finance? Or do they come to you and say, I've got a project, do you have any money?
It works both ways. We come across projects that clients are wanting to make that seem very organic. For example, right now I'm working on a film. It's a great story about a dog. It's called Hachiko. And it's just the wonderful story of a dog and the dog's loyalty with its owner. Right now, it's a good opportunity for a pet food company to get involved.
How does that process work then? You go to brands and say, hey, we've got a great script here. What do you say,
Mighty Dog? I like to let the words really speak for themselves. So I basically reach out to, you know, heads of marketing of a pet food company and say, I'm going to send you a script. Just please read it.
Do clients ever sort of bristle at the idea that, you know, God, you're going to mess my whole movie up with these weird, creepy product shots?
I think some do, but I think the secret is to find really the organic fit, you know, that we're not asking a movie about a dog to all of a sudden, you know, have a huge Starbucks in the middle of the movie. So, and why would a Starbucks be interested in that particular film? So we're really trying to find the fits that already exist.
There's one of you, so to speak, at ICM.
Well, no, I have more folks on my team.
I understood, yeah. But I'm saying at every sort of talent agency, mm-hmm. there's someone whose job it is to do what you do.
Actually not, and that's one of the things that we think is pretty unique. So the other agencies in town actually represent brands.
Mm-hmm.
We choose not to represent brands because we think it does a disservice to our talent, which is our primary focus. So
explain that sort of the nomenclature of your agency and how it's different from, let's say, William Morris, which represents brands like General Motors and Anheuser-Busch. And
we take the opposite approach. We think that the important thing for a talent agency to do is to represent its talent to brands. And we think if you represent a brand, you're doing a disservice to your talent because you're narrowing the focus of the brands they might have access to. So, for example, William Morris representing Anheuser-Busch, they obviously know Anheuser-Busch folks and can introduce Anheuser-Busch folks to their clients, but what about all the other beer companies? So we really are agnostic, and we'll work with any brand. We think that sort of in today's climate, the last thing a brand actually needs is yet another agency between their ad agency and their PR agency and their placement agency and their media buying and media planning. They have enough agencies. And we think the best thing that we can do is try to facilitate dialogue between our talent and that brand and any of its agencies.
Dumb question. How do you get paid?
Well, we represent our clients, and obviously when we grow our client's business, whether the client is the producer or the director, we work on a commission basis out of their earnings.
So if, let's say, Dove's commitment to this film, hypothetically, was $3 million, you would make $300,000 based on a flat 10% arrangement. That's usually what an agency takes, 10% of a client.
It's a little bit different when you're packaging films. So we represent the film in different areas. In addition to representing the producers of the film and the directors of the film and whatever fees they may get paid, we also represent the whole package. Now that there is a film, we can represent that film for sale in other territories around the world. So it's not so black and white.
The fact that this is sort of an open-ended, I don't want to say undefined because I'm sure it is defined, but an amorphous deal, so to speak, does that open up the possibility for problems during production? That is, if Diane English is on the set and shooting someone who is a little bit, wrinkly or fuzzy, and Dove says, look, you know, we're for real beauty, but not for that real. You know, can we maybe get someone a little, you know, softer light or younger, hotter, or?
Well, Dove is not, and you know, again, it's not their business to direct a film, and they're in no way going to tell Diane how to make the movie. We've shared with them the script, and you know, as scripts evolve a little bit, as our partner, Dove will see shooting scripts all along. So they're 100% behind this film and the vision that they've shared with Diane, and they're really more about the women behind the women who are actually making the movie. You know, whether it's the woman who's doing the lights or doing the sound or in the editing booth. They're really about the process and the real women behind making the movie.
But I guess what I'm asking is, will producers or delegates from Unilever be on set to go?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely.
And that's negotiated. They're barred from that.
They're not barred. They're not interested. And I think that you have to know your strength and what you bring to it. I mean, where Dove will be the most helpful is the noise and the marketing that Dove can lend the film during the time of its release.
What happens to a brand if the movie is a dud, so to speak? God forbid.
Well, I think that I don't think anything different happens to the brand. I remember years ago there was a tie-in with the remake of The Mod Squad, and Levi's had, before that filmed release, done some special apparel, that type of thing, and it was completely sold out at retail before the movie even opened, and the movie didn't perform, but Levi's, in being associated with that film, had already sold all its product. Mm-hmm. So the result wouldn't have been any different had it been a smash at the box office or not.
I remember that movie. It was almost as if someone forgot to tell MGM that there was no counterculture left to infiltrate. But that's a story meeting issue.
So the answer there is that nothing bad happened to the brand.
But can you wind up doing, let's say, if your commitment is, let's say, $3 million, can you do $3 million worth of damage to your brand if the movie is, you know, quel désastre?
I think consumers are smart, and I think they see a movie and they decide for themselves whether it's a good movie or a bad movie. And that doesn't mean that the brands that are in the movie or even the talent that's in the movie suffer.
So there's only upside here.
I believe there's only upside.
Lori Sale is head of Global Branded Entertainment for International Creative Management. She joined us here in KCRW Santa Monica. Lori, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Darby Maloney is associate producer of our program. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.